All right, we are at, as I say, Genesis chapter 49 and verse, 19. And I want to just make a couple of remarks here before we get started, one of which is that, as I indicated to you last week, we're not going to be going on into Exodus. I'm sorely tempted to do that because the story just continues, as you know. But what we're going to do next week, or next year, next fall would be the time, actually, in September, is a little bit of an adjustment, and I'm going to start a series which may take about half the year, presumably here in the sanctuary, in which we'll be focusing on what's traditionally called in the life of Christian thought the means of grace. We don't hear that term a whole lot, but it's kind of a classic expression for those means that God has provided through His church in particular, which are designed to build up and nourish and nurture the life of faith in Christian people and in the community of faith. And so we're going to be looking particularly at those very practical means that God has made, which include things like worship, preaching. Why preaching? You see, what is it that God intends to accomplish through that medium? Prayer, the sacraments, music, all of these things that we take for granted. We know they're part of what we experience when we come to church. But what I'd like to do is just cut a little bit beneath the surface and actually look biblically and theologically and historically at what those particular aspects of the life of faith are about. Sometimes when we become so familiar with these experiences, we lose that distance, that sense of, you know, why is it that God has chosen to do things just the way He has? I am fully aware, and I'm sure you're aware, these are controversial issues. The life is, of the church is sort of gripped in something of controversy about many of these areas. And so, but fools rush in, you know, so I'm just going to rush right into those and talk about them. Not so much to argue for various positions. I'm not going to get into contemporary worship versus traditional and that kind of stuff. What I'd rather do is just put the whole discussion in a context. And I think that context can help us. And so that's really, I've just felt increasingly the burden to do that. So anyway, that's one thing I wanted to miss. The other point, I've made very little reference to this through this year, but and most of you are aware of it, but if you're not aware of it, just a little comment. All of these lectures that we've done on Genesis this past year, the book of Acts the year before that, the minor prophets, church history, and a bunch of other stuff that we've done over the years here at First Press and elsewhere is available online as audio lectures. They're all just there, neatly organized, so you can get to them fairly easily. It's at my website, brucewgore.com. Now, I don't mention that a lot because I feel like it's sort of self-promotion, but I don't make any money off of it or anything like that, but anyway, it's all there. So you're perfectly free to access that, or if you know somebody elsewhere who might be make use or have some benefit from this material, then certainly pass the word along. The most interesting email I got not too long ago was from somebody in Ireland who had been online and listening to these lectures and wanted to actually download some of them and distribute them on a CD to some friends in Ireland. I said, whoa, that sounds like fun. So apparently, as far as I know, that's been happening. So anyway, I only mention that because I think some folks were not aware of it, and I wanted you all to be aware that that is there. And with that, we're going to come this morning now to Genesis chapter 49 and beginning at verse 19. You recall what's happening. Jacob is at the end of his life. He has summoned his family. First of all, Joseph with his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, had a special, we gather, session with them, giving pronouncements to them, patriarchal blessings. And now probably a few days later, a family gathering in which all the sons of Jacob are present. And Jacob is going through and making these pronouncements, sort of predictive prophecies mixed with blessings to each one of them. And we got through the first seven of his sons. We have five to go, and those five pick up at verse 19. But I want to just mention verse 18 here, which reads, if you notice, I will wait for your salvation, O Lord. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Commentators suspect that that was a little interjected prayer offered by Jacob, because here he is. His strength is not, you know, very abundant. He's at the end of his life. This may have been simply a prayer seeking God's strength as he's in this very important business to make it through to the end. And so he solicits God's strength for that task. And that's a good word for us to start with as well. We need to solicit God's strength for our task this morning. So let's just do so at this time. Father, we wait for your salvation. We thank you for the sermon we've heard this morning, or that we will hear a little later, about waiting before you, and that quality of patience that expects that you will come in and do those things that you are only capable and competent to do. As we come before you this morning, reaching now the culmination of our studies of the book of Genesis, we are so grateful that you have shown us in many ways through this unfolding drama the wonderful way that you guide your people, you fill them with your Spirit, you lead them through these adventures and sometimes misadventures, but all of it becomes to the glory of your name and to the honoring of Christ. We pray now that as we reach the conclusion of the story of Jacob and all of the drama that's been incorporated therein, that we would also see that the same God who graciously watched over him is present among us as well. We give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so verse 19. Now, just picking up midstream, verse 19. This is page 47, by the way, in the Pew Bible. Gad shall be raided by raiders, Jacob says, but he shall raid at their heels. The best insight here is Gad was a border tribe. That is, the real estate given to the tribe of Gad was at the kind of edges of the nation of Israel, and it was subjected to raiding parties from time to time. And so that seems to be the best that Jacob can offer with respect to the experience and destiny of the tribe of Gad. So we'll just leave it at that. Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall provide royal delicacies. Again, this is predictive. Asher was given real estate, which was very rich agriculturally. And in fact, Asher was one of the principal sources of the royal food, the food that would go to the kings, and in fact exported a fair amount of food to the other tribes. So that seems to be the best understanding there. Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears lovely fawns. An alternative rendering, you'll notice down in the footnote at the bottom, or that gives beautiful words, maybe a little bit better. Naphtali was noted as a tribe that produced kind of the singers, the poets, the bards, if you will, of Israel. And so that, again, seems to fit well with what Jacob is saying here. You can tell these are sort of blessings mixed with predictions. And this comes now to verse 22, which concerns Joseph. And much more attention is given to Joseph than these others. Judah and Joseph get the principal attention. Judah, of course, is given the position of firstborn, the status of being the firstborn son, even though he was actually born fourth. But Reuben, Simeon, and Levi both forfeited the status of being first in the family, and so Judah is installed there. However, the double blessing, which ordinarily went to the firstborn, is diverted and given to Joseph through his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. But Joseph himself is also given special treatment now in these following verses. So beginning at verse 22, we'll comment as we go. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. Joseph was a fruitful bough. He'd been through some difficult times, as you know, but now he is the source of food and sustenance, not only for his own family, but for Egypt and all of the surrounding nations. he had become, as it were, the very wellspring of survival for all of these, because he was the one who had correctly predicted through Pharaoh's dream that was fiercely attacked him. They shot him, who had opposite the spirit of the target in this great archery contest. But of course, Joseph had come out okay, and Jacob represents that in the next couple of statements. Yet his bow remained taut, his arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, by the name of the shepherd of the rock of Israel, by the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, with blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. So even though Joseph had been subjected to these very negative experiences, God had sustained him. God had kept him strong. The arms of the Almighty had undergird him. And all of this, of course, becomes a great comment on the way in which God watches over all of us in spite of what the circumstances of life may deal us. And then this final comment that concludes this statement about Joseph. The blessings of your father are stronger than the blessings of the eternal mountains, the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph, on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers. The blessings of the fathers, referring to the blessings of the patriarchs. The blessing that Jacob was giving Joseph was the same blessing that Isaac had given Jacob, was the same blessing that Abraham had given Isaac, was the same blessing that God had given Abraham. It's the patriarchal, fatherly blessing. And Jacob says here, this blessing that I'm pronouncing on you, Joseph, is more eternal than the mountains. You know, you go and you look at Mount Spokane, you think that mountain's been there a long time. Mountains seem to be the symbol of that which is most permanent, most, or maybe I should say, least susceptible to change and deterioration. You know, what is it? Is it North, which insurance company? The Rock of Gibraltar. It stands for that which is permanent and fixed. But these patriarchal blessings are more permanent than even the great mountains. And this that God had given to Abraham and now devolves to Joseph will continue down through the history of Israel, reaching its consummate expression in Messiah. And if you are in Messiah, then that blessing has come to you. And that great blessing of the fathers is as much our heritage, you see, as it was Joseph's and his children. This is part of the reason but the whole story of the Bible is how God has preserved and protected his people and indeed brought us in eventually to become recipients of that same great blessing. So these are more eternal than the mountains, that they are the great blessings that God has given, and they are now passed on to Joseph. And, of course, through him would come down through the people of God. Finally, verse 27, the last of these sons is Benjamin. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning, devouring the prey, and at evening, dividing the spoil. Benjamin was the youngest son, of course, who hailed the Old Testament. You'll find that very frequently they are associated with the kind of warring class, soldiers and great fighters came from Benjamin. Sometimes, not always, fighting for the best causes. There are some embarrassing moments with respect to Benjamin, but nevertheless, that does seem to be descriptive. So all of that then becomes the discussion of the blessings that fall to these 12 tribes. We had to finish up, of course, those details this morning. And now we come to verse 28 and really properly move into chapter 50. All of these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them when he blessed them, blessing each of them with a suitable blessing. End of conversation. And now the final moments of Jacob's life, verse 29. Then he charged them, saying to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my ancestors in the cave in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave of the field of Machpelah near Mamre in the land of Canaan, in the field that Abraham bought from Ephraim the Hittite as a burial site. There Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried. There Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were purchased from the Hittites. Then Jacob ended his charge to his sons. He drew up his feet into his bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph threw himself on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph commanded the physicians in his service to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. They spent 40 days in doing this, for that's the time required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. So this, of course, reaching this culminating moment now of Jacob's life. He charged them to bury him in Canaan at this family cemetery that Abraham had originally purchased from the Hittites. This is given quite a bit of attention because this is really the only land that was part of the patriarchal possession at the time. Jacob had, of course, purchased some land in Shechem, but the principal real estate in Canaan that was owned by this family was just that little cemetery. Here God had given them all of that land, as far as the eye could see, north and south, east and west, but all that they actually had was a little piece of real estate, and that was only a cemetery. And it's a point that's picked up in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, to talk about how these people were such people of faith. Jacob is deeply moved by faith. That's what causes him to require that he be buried in Canaan. Because even though he owns virtually none of it, by faith he owns all of it. And he wants to confirm that by insisting that he be buried there in his homeland, not in some rich pyramid tomb kind of thing in Egypt. None of that. No, a little modest cemetery in Canaan, because that's where the promises had been made. And of course, that's a lesson for us as well, that we live seeing quite a face, wept over him and kissed him. Very tender pass here, for they've been reunited after about 20 years of being separated. And so the very tumultuous life of Jacob reached a relatively happy and peaceful conclusion, as far as we can tell. Joseph, of course, gives free vent to his emotion. That's okay. The Bible just takes for granted that there is a certain emotion, a certain mourning that comes along in the normal human experience with death. The New Testament, however, warns us against over-grieving. In fact, Paul tells us, warns us specifically not to grieve, as do the pagans who have no hope. That in some ways, if we become too swept away in mourning, too swept away in grief, that borders on a kind of anger and resentment toward God that is not healthy. That in fact, we are called to grieve, at least we are permitted, and maybe I should say to grieve, but at the same time, our view of death, especially those who die in faith, who die in Christ, is that mixed with that grief should be a healthy dose of celebration, a healthy dose of rejoicing. I think most of you, as I have been in many memorial services in this very room, and what a delight it is to celebrate the lives of people who have been just a story of faithful service in the kingdom. And oftentimes, you know, a few tears are mixed with a lot of joy, a little laughter, and it really can be quite a joyful moment to celebrate a life lived well by the grace of God. And so even though we certainly have these mourning moments, we are cautioned against giving too much of the kind of sadness of the sense of loss, giving way too much to a lot. And so those not knows in embalming. Usually the experts were the priests. They were the ones who did all of the embalming. They were the experts. But here Joseph doesn't call on them, probably because the priests who served the pagan pantheon of Egypt would mix into their embalming techniques all kinds of religious overtones. It really became as much a religious observation as it was any sort of just simple preservation of the body. There was a considerable amount of concern about the afterlife and how this person was going to interact with the afterlife and providing in various ways for that in a fashion that would be biblically unacceptable. And Joseph here himself is probably avoiding that, and so specifically refers to the physicians. Physicians didn't normally do the embalming. They knew how to. They were competent to do it. But here, Joseph probably chooses them because he doesn't want all of that religious overtone connected to it. He just wants the simple procedures that the Egyptians had perfected to be utilized with respect to Jacob. So they embalmed Israel. They spent 40 days in doing this, for that's the time required for embalming, which is correct. Herodotus tells us also it took 40 days for the Egyptians to embalm a body. They had quite an elaborate process. I will not go into detail on it, but nevertheless, it was quite an extended process, and it took about 40 days. And then, interestingly, he says the Egyptians wept for him for 70 days, suggesting once again that Jacob was held in very high status, undoubtedly because of his connection with Joseph. But 70 days of mourning were associated with very high royalty. Very significant people would be mourned for 72 days, actually, in Egypt. And so this 70 days accords, once again, very, very well with what we otherwise know about ancient Egypt. All right, then at verse 4, when the days for weeping for him were past, Joseph addressed the household of Pharaoh, "If now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh as follows. My father made me swear an oath. He said, I'm about to die. In the tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now therefore let me go up that I may bury my father, then I will return." Pharaoh answered him, "Go up and bury your father as he made you swear to do." Interestingly, that Joseph doesn't go directly to Pharaoh. He sends this word through a third party. I read one commentator who actually suggested that that implied that Joseph had lost status. Or maybe this was a new Pharaoh who didn't view Joseph quite so favorably, and so Joseph no longer had free access to the presence of the Pharaoh. I don't think so. I think the better insight by far is that Joseph has been now in a state of mourning for 70 days. And in the Semitic culture, when you mourn, you don't cut your hair and you don't shave your beard. But if you're going to go before Pharaoh, you always go shaven of head and beard. You see, that was the Egyptian custom. And so at this point, Joseph is not in a position appearance-wise in which it's appropriate to come before the Pharaoh. He doesn't want to terminate his mourning yet because his father is not yet buried, and so he appropriately sends through a third party for permission to bury his father, and of course that is cordially given here by the Pharaoh, so that's probably the explanation for that particular anomaly. Then beginning at verse 7, "So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of the household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers and his father's household. Only the children and their flocks and their herds were left behind in Goshen. Them of great beyond the nation, the more 7 days. When the Canaanites, they said, this is a grievous mourning. There was for Mestra, they to the field of Machpelah, the field near Mamre, which Abraham bought as a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father." That paragraph is really quite self-explanatory. I don't want to make any further comment about it, except to note that this was a really big observance, so much so that even the Canaanite population noticed that this must be some extraordinary person who was being celebrated in this great burial observance. And it is a bit of a reflection, you see, of how God will exalt His people even in this world. Sometimes, even though they go through harrowing experiences, God is also the one who can exalt them in remarkable ways. Maybe the most interesting example of that concerns Christ Himself. It's a point we kind of skip over, but I think it's worth noting. Isaiah 53 says of Christ, He was put to death with criminals, Isaiah 53, but then he adds, was buried with the rich. And Jesus, of course, was buried in the tomb of a rich man, and presumably in a cemetery inhabited, as it were, or owned by other rich people. As if to say, even though Jesus died this horrific and shameful death, even before his resurrection, God was beginning to glorify him. He was buried with the rich, you see. And you'll see little traces of that. Jacob, he's just a man who had lived in Canaan and had some tough experiences through his life. But even now, this huge celebration so that Egypt itself participates in recognizing what a special person he was, probably unwittingly to some degree. So anyway, just that little note in passing. Coming now to really the critical paragraph of this entire chapter, which is the next one, beginning at verse 15. Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong we did to him?" So they approached Joseph saying, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now, therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him and said, "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to harm me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." In this way he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. Well, you can see what happened here. The brothers, of course, have been very pleased with the cordial and warm and affectionate treatment that they've received from the hands of their brother. But they've always harbored a little bit of angst, you know, a little worry. Maybe the only reason that Joseph has been so kind to us is in deference to the old man. As long as Jacob's around, Joseph's going to treat us nicely. But once Jacob's gone, then watch out, you see. Now Joseph's going to get his vengeance. And I think that was probably still lurking in the back of the minds of these brothers. They remembered so well how they had abused Joseph. And now that Jacob is no longer there, is the kind of mollifying influence, you know, what's going to happen. And so that's clearly reflected now in their concern. What if Joseph is now going to pay us back in full, you know, for what we did to him? So, invoking all the moral authority they can, they say, "Now, Joseph, Dad said, you know, don't do this. Forgive these guys the evil that they did." And, well, you know, presumably Dad did say that. I don't think they made this up out of whole cloth, but they wanted, you know, they want to pull every ace out of every hole they can think of to try to prevent Joseph from wreaking against them the vengeance that they so richly yet deserved. And so they remind Joseph of what Jacob had said and so on. And, of course, Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Joseph wept. He wept undoubtedly because it reminded him of all that he'd been through. It reminded him of the abuse that he had sustained and his life. Even though it had ended very well, with great prominence and dignity and so on, had not always been easy. He'd spent some time in prison. He'd been falsely accused, all of those things. And he wept about it. He wept undoubtedly because he saw evidence in this, that these men's hearts had really been changed. I don't know about you, you know, one of the most tear-jerking things I can experience is when I see a life that was just a hard-boiled commitment to everything wrong, and then see that life changed by God's grace, and see somebody who had lived such a life of rebellion against God come to terms with him. That, to me, is a very emotional thing. And anytime you've heard a testimonial of somebody telling such a story. To me, it's just very moving to see how God's grace can insinuate itself into the hardest of hearts and change them. And I think probably that moved Joseph to some extent, that he saw even in this fearful repeat request that he would treat them not as they deserved. Joseph was touched and moved by that emotionally. Probably Joseph was weeping over this because he was sad that they still were worried about it, you know, that they still didn't really quite believe that Joseph was sincere in the promises that he'd been making to them. And there may be other reasons, but we can certainly understand why he would be moved deeply by this. They continue saying, "We are your slaves." There's not a bit of pride or arrogance, self-defense left in them. The true and genuine humility of these men is now coming out in full measure. And that, of course, was what Joseph was concerned about all along. "We are your slaves." And then Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God?" And then Joseph articulates one of the most profound theological propositions anywhere in the Scriptures. And it's a classic expression of something that is quite deeply mysterious, but nevertheless is part of the biblical wisdom and counsel to us. And it's in these words, "Even though you intended to harm me, God intended it for good." Or to put it more trenchantly, and I've seen it put this way, and I prefer it this way, "What you intended for harm, God intended for good." You see. Not simply that God was able to execute a plan B to do some damage control after you guys really screwed it up. You know, it's not that God just steps in after the fact to try to, you know, put something back together that was really messed up by these. No. What you intended, the very thing you intended, and it was a wicked, evil, inexcusable intent on your part, meshed, fused into that very intent, was God's intent. And God was intending something good in the very intention that you, on your part, intended for something evil. And that, of course, brings us right up, face to face, doesn't it, with this whole deep question. How can God be sovereign, and yet we be morally responsible for the things that we do? God's sovereignty, and yet human moral freedom and responsibility. Wow. You ever thought about that before? You know, that's one of those scary topics, isn't it, in theology. And I think sometimes we just sort of throw up our hands in despair immediately and say, "Who can understand that?" and walk away. And that's probably what I ought to do, but I've got 13 minutes left, so let me just plow right in, you know, and it's the end of the year, here we go. First of all, let's be aware of this. This is not the only mystery in Christian theology. In fact, to me, one of the hallmarks of genuine Orthodox Christian teaching is that as you press into it, at any point, you will eventually reach mystery. Now, that doesn't mean we should despair. We are invited to explore as deeply as we can, but to modestly acknowledge when we reach the edge of the abyss and say, you know, there's more out there, but how do we get from here to there? That's true at every point in theology. The mark of a heresy, the mark of a cult, is they answer every question. Cut and dried. No mystery. Christian theology is loaded with mystery. And that's what makes it so rich. So you think about God and the Trinity. One substance, three in person. It's mystery. You think about Christ. Two natures in one person. It's mystery. You think about the atonement. How Christ could take upon himself the very flame of hell, extinguishing it for us there on the cross. That's mystery. The mystery of God's Spirit coming on the day of Pentecost, as we were being reminded even today. The mystery of the whole story of redemption. We should be as inquisitive as we reverently can be and yet modestly acknowledge when we reach the edge and say there's still more out there. There's still more. And we don't know it all. We should seek as much as we can, but hold back where we can. Well, this subject is one of those kinds of issues. We are invited to know as much as we can, and yet recognize there's a point where our human inquiry comes to that kind of limit, you know. Well, my favorite expression in classic theology that gets at this point is in the venerable Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 3, paragraph 1, and here it is. This is basically the way it goes, the words to this effect. Listen to this. God has from all eternity freely and unchangeably ordained whatever comes to pass. God has from all eternity freely and unchangeably ordained whatever comes to pass. In other words, God is God. God is sovereign. God is the one who has, in a sense, mapped out the whole story. What these men intended for harm, God intended for good. It was part of His divine plan. Not an accident, not an unforeseen fortuity, strange misstep. God had to make some fast moves. No. God is freely and unchangeably ordained, whatever comes to pass. Now, the Westminster then wisely puts a hedge around that proposition, warning us against three possible distortions, three ways we can misunderstand that basic point. And so it spells them out in these terms. One, God is not thereby made the author of sin. Two, no violence is offered to the will of the creature. Three, the liberty and contingency of second causes is not thereby done away with, but rather established. That's the Westminster Confession, chapter 3, paragraph 1. So what are those three hedges saying? Well, the first one, God is not made thereby the author of sin. God has ordained whatever comes to pass, but God is not the perpetrator of the evil that takes place. Here, it was an evil, wicked thing when Joseph was sold as a slave into Egypt. And yet God intended through that to accomplish good things. God is in no sense the perpetrator of the crime against Joseph. I think the clearest illustration of that is when Satan came before God and said, "Hey, I want to go devastate the life of Job." And God said, "I give you permission." Now, the devastator of the life of Job was Satan. That was the moving evil force. But please bear in mind, Satan could not do one thing beyond what God permitted. Satan had to ask permission to do his wicked work. And if God gives permission, he doesn't do it accidentally, he does it intentionally. And so if God gave permission, it's because he intended to give permission. And if he intended to give, decided it from all eternity. Intended, in and of itself, was a bad thing, but from God's point of view, it was for a good purpose. God causes all things to work together for good, you see, to those who are called according to his purpose. So that's very carefully protected biblically. God is not perpetrating crimes, but he is ordaining those things that happen. Judas committed an unspeakable crime against Christ, betraying him into the hands of the authorities to be crucified. But that wasn't a mistake. That was something God had ordained, you see, from all eternity, that it should happen just that way. Number two, no violence is offered to the will of the creature. Joseph's brothers were not being manipulated into selling Joseph into prison. This was a free choice for which they were perfectly culpable. They did this and they bore the blame for it. And yet, it was precisely what God had ordained should happen. Now, this is the tough one. Let me just put it to you as trenchantly as I can. I think it would be probably best stated in these words from a traditional Reform perspective. God ordains free human choices. God doesn't just ordain actions. He ordains the free, human, responsible choices that we make. But they are our choices. And they are choices for which we are responsible. Now, a question that comes to mind usually at this point is, how can God do that? How can God ordain free human choices? And you'll be happy to know I'm not going to give you the correct theological answer to that. It comes in two words. Beats me! Yeah. Who can explain that? But the question I want to give you is this. Just because, now maybe you can, I can't explain how God does it, but just because probably none of us can explain that is in itself no argument that God is incapable of doing it. The fact that I don't get it is really quite irrelevant to whether God gets it. You see, God is, after all, God. And until I achieve infinite intelligence, which I'm warned I'll probably never do, I probably will never quite get it. But then there's all kinds of things. We could stand here for hours on end talking about the things that we don't get, how God does. How does God bring creation into being ex nihilo? How does God do anything that He does? How can God be this infinite intelligence that knows the movements of every molecule in the universe at all times, presently in His mind? How does God do that? I don't know. But do you think that in our petty, little, paltry intelligence, we can therefore stand in judgment as to whether God can do what He manifestly says He can do? What you intended for harm, God intended for good, you see? At this point, we have to say, okay, there's a mystery there. But I'm not going to let my lack of understanding of the mystery leave me, in fact, with the Lord and holy ordained, with a predictable God-hating. We live in a rational universe, which is the production of a rational deity who has given us a kind of orderliness about life upon which we can base our plans and expectancies, and that creates a life of sanity rather than insanity. And so the Westminster is careful to affirm for us that nothing in this should be viewed as a license to begin seeing the world as sort of filled with superstitious kinds of movements that don't have some reasonable explanation in the world of cause and effect. Now, I'm not even pretending to have explained, the nub of the problem, but I hope you see, at least from the point of view of classical theology, some things have been said, I think, based on, good biblical, sound, sane understanding of what the Bible leads us to believe and to teach, and yet we at the same time have to modestly say, there's a little bit of this we still don't get. And how can it be that what these men intended for harm, God intended for good? How can that be? But that it can be is exactly what the Scriptures affirm to us. And so the life of obedient faith requires that we embrace it, though we may not fully get it. And that principle gives us great comfort. Personally, I find great comfort in knowing that I live in a universe that is not spinning out of control. And that even when things happen in my life that I don't particularly like, that I know that there is a sovereign God who is behind even these painful things and who has promised that He will cause all these things to work together for good. That brings great comfort to me. Some people find that uncomfortable. They'd rather have an out of control universe with a limited deity. Not me. I like a God who is God. And so maybe that's just personal taste at this point, but I do believe that's what the Scriptures certainly lead us to believe. Oh dear. Okay, now let's just finish this up very quickly. Verse 22. Joseph remained in Egypt. He and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were also born to Joseph's knees, or held on his knees would be the notion there. Then Joseph said to his brothers, not his literal brothers now, but his clan, as it were. We've skipped ahead many years. I am about to die, but God will surely come to you and bring you up out of this land to the land that He swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So Joseph made the Israelites swear, saying, when God comes to you, you shall carry up my bones from here. And Joseph died being 110 years old. He was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. And with that, we reach the end of our studies of the book of Genesis, and that's all I want to say on the subject. We've got about 1 minute. Any closing comments, questions? Well, thank you. Thank you. And to you, too. I do appreciate your faithful attendance. And all right, let's have a word of prayer and we'll be dismissed. Our Father, we are so deeply grateful that you have given us the opportunity to begin this excursion, this odyssey through the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings, the book of creation, the book of redemption, all of these great themes that are brought to our attention. We thank you for this year that we've had together, for the blessings that you have shed into each of our lives by virtue of these sessions of conversation. And we just give you thanks now for the summer that lies before us, for the little break that we look forward to. We ask that in all of this, you would lift up the name of Christ, that we would be led ever more deeply to the worship and adoration of him. We ask these things in Jesus' name.